Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Dave Cushing, and I'm here with John Wells. Our next guest this morning is Dr. Shelley Jane, who is a post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, specialist at the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System in California, a trauma scientist at the National Center for PTSD, and a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University's School of Medicine. Her new book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science, went on sale earlier this week. In her book, Shelley writes, PTSD seeps beyond the confines of the mind to infiltrate cells and bodily organs. It has emerged as a risk factor for a host of medical conditions, from heart disease and cancer to obesity and autoimmune disorders. New research shows how PTSD resulting from mass traumatization such as torture, slavery, and genocide can leave an imprint that spans generations. Dr. Shelley, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Morning. Thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah. Hey, great. So how did you become interested in the field of PTSD and begin researching and writing about it?
So obviously I'm a physician and I've spent two decades caring for thousands of patients who have survived child abuse, rape, intimate partner violence, life-threatening accidents, and war. So it's hard for that not to feel personal after a while and get very moved by the plight of how people live in the aftermath of surviving the unspeakable. On a personal note, my own family history is one of trauma and tragedy. Two, during the 1947 partition of British India, my paternal grandfather was murdered, and that meant that my father, who was 10 at the time, was forced to flee his home, live as a refugee in India, and work as a child laborer. So he ended up as an adult moving to England, and that's where I was born and raised. But I feel still the events of that year, 1947, still kind of cast this long shadow many decades earlier. So I think I've always, many decades later, so I feel like I've always been intrigued with how trauma leaves a footprint and how to make sense of that.
In your book, you talk about the four or five main causes of PTSD. Could you review at least a couple of those?
So in terms of the traumas, PTSD can result after many traumas. Rape, family violence, being robbed at gunpoint, escaping a major fire or car accident, you know, being a refugee who's forced to flee are just some examples. And the reality is that more than half of Americans will say that at some point in their life they've lived through such a trauma, and a subset would have experienced multiple traumas. Obviously, the vast majority of people will heal naturally, but a significant minority won't heal. And that means that at any given moment in time, 6 million Americans are suffering from PTSD.
6 million, boy. Dr. Shelley, you have a fascinating background, and in one area, you're the professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine, and then you're also in this very difficult environment, I would imagine, at the VA in Palo Alto as a PTSD specialist. We hear a lot of reports that that the VA has trouble getting to a lot of its patients and that sort of thing. What's the current status at the VA? Are they doing a better job, you think?
So access to mental health care is a problem all over this country. There's a shortage of mental health professionals everywhere, especially in our rural towns and in our inner cities. So I'm a doctor who's worked in healthcare systems, not only in America, but overseas too, because I was born and raised in England and I did my medical school training there. So access is a problem everywhere. I'm happy that I work somewhere where access to mental health care services is a really number one priority. So we have very clear mandates to meet that if somebody comes in, if a patient comes in, and they need to be evaluated by a mental health professional, oftentimes we can get same-day access. you know, we have very clear guidelines by which we have to get them an appointment to see somebody. And the where I work, I lead a team, is an integrated care team, where as a psychiatrist, I actually sit in primary care. I don't sit in an office somewhere far away. I actually sit in primary care, and I see patients right there as they come see their primary care doctor. If they need to see a mental health professional, I'll see them right there. And that really helps reduce a lot of the stigma for patients about seeing a mental health professional. It really improves access to care. It's a very kind of warm handoff between their regular doctor and their psychiatrist. And for me, it's really rewarding because I feel like I've been seeing the patients I've always seen throughout my whole career, but I'm just meeting them like 10, 15 years earlier.
Right. And there's a direct relationship between when you first work with a customer and how the outcome would be. So the sooner you get to them, the better. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Early intervention is key. So, you know, the same way we talk about screening for cancer or screening for heart disease, right? You want to get in there early because then things are contained. It's the same for mental health conditions. You know, if they kind of go unaddressed, it rolls into something worse, especially with PTSD. PTSD rarely lives alone. It's often accompanied with issues like addiction or depression or anxiety disorders. So if you don't, you know, target the symptoms early, you run the risk of getting it complicated, and then it's tougher to treat.
From a theoretical perspective, your book outlines how PTSD is a disorder of memories. And can you tell our listeners what you mean by that?
Yeah, of course. So disruption to memories is a quintessential feature of PTSD. There's two types of memory in PTSD. First are the involuntary, unwanted, vivid and emotional memories of the trauma. And this is where the survivor is reliving the trauma. They're very intense, they're disruptive. They've been described as these indelible images. And they can intrude into a survivor's life like days, weeks, months, and years after the trauma. These memories, they're what we call implicit memories in that, you know, the survivor doesn't retrieve them deliberately. They're often activated by environmental cues or triggers. So, for example, if you take a woman who was sexually assaulted, if the rapist wore a certain aftershave, the smell of that aftershave could trigger involuntary memories of the rape for years to come. The second type of memory in PTSD is the voluntarily recalled trauma narrative. And these are explicit memories, and they're noticeable for being disorganized and vague. And that can explain how a survivor knows they were traumatized by something. But at the same time, if you ask them, oh, tell me about it, sometimes they can't recall much details about the event because the memories are so disorganized. So it's a bit paradoxical, but yes, PTSD is definitely a disruption to one's memories.
In the case of the aftershave triggering the memory, is there treatment for that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And this triggering phenomenon forms the basis of many of the talk therapies that work very well for people who have PTSD. In essence, what's going on is that a lot of those connecting the dots between the triggers and the memories and the intrusive memories and all of the anxiety and the physiological response to being reminded, connecting the dots between those triggers and the memories is the key part of therapy, because a lot of times survivors can't spontaneously do that. And you really have to take apart the memories to be able to make those connections as to what your trigger points are. And then once the survivor knows what their trigger points are, they're empowered. They're back in the driver's seat. You know, that's what I always tell patients, that the whole point of doing therapy is that you're back in the driver's seat. You're in control of your memories. Your memories aren't in control of you anymore.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Shelley Jane. She's a PTSD specialist at the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System. She's a trauma scientist at the National Center for PTSD, and she's a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University's School of Medicine. Dr. Jane, there's a couple things in your book I'd like to shine a light on. A couple of facts. One is barely a third of people with PTSD received mental health treatment. And the second one was for every 100 service members who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, 20 will develop PTSD. Those are pretty shocking facts, aren't they?
Well, the risks of developing PTSD are directly related to your dose of exposure to trauma. But then obviously when we think of our military personnel, when you think of first responders, their occupational exposure to trauma is so high that that increases the odds that they will develop PTSD. And then on the flip side to your earlier fact that you recall from the book, integral to the nature of the disorder of PTSD is that the sufferer is often avoidant or mistrustful. So then they become hard to reach. You know, they're not, oftentimes there is a resistance to them seeking help for the symptoms, and that becomes a challenge in getting them help in a timely fashion.
Yeah, and this past January, I watched a documentary. I think it was called 72 or 74. It was named after every 72 minutes a service person takes their life. And they must be holding a lot. I mean, there's as you said earlier in the conversation, a lot of people aren't getting the mental health counseling that they need, the help that they need. But then, as you've just said, a lot of people hold this stuff in, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge issue. Anybody who has PTSD, they're living with an elevated risk of death by suicide, and that's the same for many kind of serious mental health conditions. And yes, that is part of the issue. Here's the thing. You know, trauma often represents the violation of everything we hold to be dear and sacred, and the events can sometimes become simply too terrible to utter aloud, and they often become unspeakable. You know, sometimes a survivor does want to speak, but then the wider community isn't able to bear witness to their story for whatever reason, and so then the survivor is forced into silence. The problem is PTSD thrives in such conditions. You know, the traumatic thoughts and memories, if they remain unspeakable or unthinkable for too long, they interfere with our brain's natural process of recovery after trauma. They become these stuck points that inhibit the mental reintegration that is needed for healing to occur. So making the unspeakable permanently speakable is such a key part of treatment. So if we can't even, you know, meet people who need our help, that becomes a major barrier and a major issue.
Right, and your book talks about why speaking about your trauma over and over again is the very best way to disarm its power to harm. Over and over again, that must be hard for the trauma sufferer, or does it get easier? What are the aspects of that angle?
Yeah, and so I should just emphasize with a caveat, with a skilled mental health professional, you know, that is really key. That exposure that you're alluding to, that is a secret ingredient in a lot of trauma, in a lot of therapies that work very well for PTSD. Exposure is the key piece, but it has to be done with a skilled mental health professional. And yes, you're right. The idea of speaking about your trauma again and again and working through it is really daunting for sufferers. There's no doubt about it, because the minute they even... The second they even think about doing that, their anxiety goes up, their blood pressure goes up. I think if you have access to a skilled mental health professional with whom you have a trusting, caring relationship, they can coach and guide you through that. And at some point, once you've engaged in that process, the anxiety will start to go down. That's the whole point of doing this. And then your body is not having that reaction to memories of the trauma the way that it did. And ultimately, it can just start you on that pathway to healing. But you're right, for many people, it is daunting. And that's why, you know, a lot of alternative treatments that don't tap so much into the cognitive or the intellectual, they're very popular too amongst PTSD sufferers and survivors.
Well, what are some of those other treatments? that don't tap into the cognitive other than talk therapy?
Right. So, absolutely. So, there are some therapies that work for PTSD that do not specifically focus on the trauma, and they focus more on, the consequences of living with PTSD. So oftentimes people who live with PTSD, they have trouble regulating their emotions, like, for example, they can go from 0 to 100 in 3 seconds, or it has an impact on their relationship with the people they love. They might be having marital tensions, or they might not be the parent that they want to be. So there are some treatments, for example, skills training in affective and interpersonal regulation, also known as STAIR, STAIR, and ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. They're two examples that come to my mind of other therapies that also work, but they don't focus on the trauma as much. And then there's a lot of intrigue into mind-body treatments like mindfulness, relaxation, yoga, Tai Chi, massage, acupuncture, hypnosis. They're very popular, and the evidence to support their use isn't quite as robust as the data that we have for the other therapies that I have reported, but these are currently being very actively investigated.
I was going to ask you why you named your book The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science, but I think I figured it out. I mean, it's the unspeakable, it's the trauma, the shame, it's so difficult for the person to come to terms with this, isn't it?
Absolutely, 100%, you got it right. There we go. It's the silence around it, it's the denial of it or the avoidance of it that makes it unspeakable, but that in itself creates the problem.
Dr. Jane, why does societal shame and stigma continue to surround the victims of sexual abuse crimes?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think we know that the socially disadvantaged have often borne the brunt of the most traumas that our society exposes people to. So part of me feels that because historically women have been much more likely to be the victims of rape, and I think historically because women all over the world may not have had the same rights and the same voice as their male counterparts, then I think crimes involving sexual violence just carry on having this unnecessary stigma. The problem is when a crime such as rape carries a stigma, the rape survivor who risks being shamed is often forced into silence. And then, as we mentioned earlier, the silence bolsters rape's power to wreak havoc on her life. Sometimes the survivor does speak up, but they often face what we call these secondary injuries from people who subtly or not so subtly blame her. We know that post-trauma social support is really powerful in helping survivors heal, especially women. So when they're denied that support, the consequences are really, really devastating. It continues. I feel, in light of movements, like recently in the last couple of years, we've had this Me Too movement. I feel like if movements like that can translate to less stigma shrouding rape, and less secondary injuries for survivors who speak up, and if it means that there's more social support for survivors in general, that could only mean benefit in terms of reduced PTSD rates in the future. It's almost like adding salt to injury. If someone's sexually assaulted, but on top of that, they're stigmatized or they're ostracized because of it, that's the bit that can become unbearable for survivors.
It makes the difference between recovering and not recovering. If you look at just two quick environments. First environment is the shame and the stigma. It's a horrific act, rape, but they come back and the husband and all their support people are very, very genuinely empathetic. And then you look at another environment where someone's subtly throwing the cues that, well, you dress provocatively or you shouldn't have done this or shouldn't have done that. And that completely changes the ability to be able to heal. Is that what you're saying?
Very, very true. Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm saying. you cannot underestimate the power of social support, community support, in helping survivors of all disasters and traumas heal. That makes all the difference. But obviously, in our society, it's really variable who gets support, right? I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into determining that. And if you're not so lucky, then the way you recover is going to be, the trajectory of the way you recover is totally going to be interfered with. But you're right. You're absolutely right.
Last question with 2 or 3 minutes to go is there a genetic or hereditary component to PTSD? And if
yes,
so, what?
Yes, absolutely. So, although by definition, PTSD is linked to this external traumatic event, the reality is that the vast majority of people who are exposed to traumas, they will not develop PTSD. They will obviously be emotionally shaken. They will have psychological symptoms, but they'll be temporary. And with the passage of time, these people will heal spontaneously. A substantial minority will develop PTSD, though, and research has shown that it's actually very heritable in terms of who develops PTSD and who doesn't. So genetic factors probably account for 1/3 of the overall risk of developing PTSD following exposure to traumatic events.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, society can work to prevent this large incident of PTSD?
So there's a lot of really great work that we've been doing in the field of PTSD and trauma to try and prevent. The last 20 years, we've just done a lot of work in prevention, and there's many ways we can prevent on any violence prevention programs that are proven to be effective, that we can roll out on a mass scale. That's the best way to go about trying to prevent PTSD. If we prevent violent acts, if we prevent, mass shootings, or we prevent family violence, or we prevent sexual violence, then you end up, reducing rates of PTSD. There's a lot of interventions we can do in the immediate aftermath of people surviving trauma to help reduce their odds of developing PTSD. There's programs like psychological first aid. There's been some experimental work with the use of the stress hormone cortisol. The biggest thing I focus on, because this is the type of research that I do, is what can we do to re-engineer healthcare to make it more accessible, acceptable, and available to sufferers? So trying to reach the hard to reach, using like technology or integrative care or peer support models, so that people can engage in treatment more easily, that also is an act of prevention.
Dr. Shelley Jane, your book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. Thanks so much for being here on Cool Science Radio today.